Good morning, good afternoon, or good evening. I'm your host, Marcus Gillis, and we are recording live from Banjo, Colorado. Population growing. Welcome to episode number 16 of the Live from Banjo podcast. For those of you that are new to the show, welcome, and those returning, thank you. Please remember to follow or subscribe on Spotify, Apple, or wherever you get your podcasts. And if you're on Apple, please leave a review if you enjoy the show. Please follow me on Instagram at Live from Banjo Podcast. And as always, you can go in my link in my bio on Instagram and find lots of cool stuff connected to the show, which also has the show's mixtape on Spotify. And it's a few songs from all the previous guests. So it's really, really good. Hey, Crystal, today we are introducing Matt Davidson.
Yes, we are. Of Twain.
He's kind of a mythical creature.
Ethereal?
Ethereal.
Is that the word that I'm looking for?
I don't know. But he doesn't do a lot of interviews and things, or doesn't seem to have done a lot of audio recorded interviews. So felt special.
It was a pretty special interview.
I apologize, everybody. There are times where my audio gets a little low and wonky, but I'm used to being somewhat big, I guess, in my personality.
You mean loud?
Yeah. And Matt definitely brought me down very quickly to where I felt like I was whispering. And so
Matt didn't bring you down. Matt just quieted you.
That's what I meant. Yes.
Matt is not a Debbie Downer. No, he's fine.
Yeah, no, it was we were very pleasant and happy and we laughed lots of times, but because he's quiet, he made me quiet and I may have needed to pump up my audio a little bit. So I had to tinker a little bit in post because I kind of felt like I was whispering throughout the interview because I didn't want to be
overbearing.
Yeah, like I am. So today I sit down with Matt Davidson, the incredible singer and songwriter behind the band Twain. If you haven't listened to Twain, then I'm so excited for you. And if you have, then you know what I'm talking about. Twain is fairly new in my life and immediately became one of my favorite bands. I have had conversations with multiple incredible musicians since finding his music, and they told me that Matt was probably their favorite songwriter working and playing today. Matt was born in Virginia, but also spent a number of his formative years in Bay Area of California. He started writing songs at a young age and spent some time studying at Berklee College of Music in Boston. And he has been a touring musician with a number of incredible bands, including but not limited to the Spirit Family Reunion, Low Anthem, and of course, Twain. He is an incredibly talented musician and he has a spirit that it seems like you can almost hear him play through his instrument. And I know Paul kind of talked about that when he was on the show, and I don't remember if Langhorn and I discussed that in the actual episode, but I may have read in another interview where he said something similar, or I've heard some other people say that you can hear his essence when he picks up an instrument, not just when he's singing, though he is an incredible singer. Twain has put out 5 full-length albums, multiple EPs, and he just recently finished recording their 6th album to be released later this year. He is also a regular touring member with Langhorn Slim, and when they call themselves the Lost at Last Band, he is part of that group. And he has recorded on 3 of Slim's albums, including Strawberry Mansion, which was released this year, 2021. And then he also was on multiple songs on Paul's album, Paul DeFeglia.
From Daylight.
In Daylight.
Well, from Daylight Studios.
In Daylight, recorded in Daylight. Studio is named Daylight.
Yes,
please. But they were in Daylight. At the end of the episode, Matt promotes a virtual benefit concert, Abolition 2021. Well, after this interview was over, I did some research on the Abolition Apostles, who in collaboration with Jody Holland and Joanna Samuels have built up an amazing line of talent to raise money to support the creation of a hospitality house for friends, families, lawyers, and advocates visiting folks at the Louisiana State Penitentiary at Angola. They have 3 more shows coming up this month. However, I did an interview with the co-founders of Abolition Apostles, and it's a really interesting and all the details for the live stream can be found through the show notes for episode 15. And we also have a link up on livefrombanjo.com. So if you get finished and want to find out more about Abolition Apostles and mass incarceration, your discussion on racism and the U.S. prison system, then go back and listen to episode 15. Now, please enjoy our conversation. You weren't a part of it.
No, I wasn't. I never get to have the fun.
Now, please enjoy my conversation with the incredibly talented and very soft-spoken Mr. Matt Davidson. Your video is excellent.
Oh, yeah. It's just the computer. How's the audio?
The audio sounds good, too.
Cool.
How you doing, man?
Good. Nice to meet you over the...
Nice to meet you. I really am just one of those people. I'm kind of a Luddite and kind of just don't like technology. But then at the same time, I'm like, well, but I can miraculously talk with somebody in another place and record this interview.
Yeah.
Which is pretty lucky. Are you in Austin now? That's where you live in. And you've been there for how long? A few years?
Oh, a year and a half.
2019. That makes sense. It feels like longer.
If that counts as a year and a half after the last year.
Yeah. It's one of those things where, I don't know, I was talking to somebody and I was saying it feels like the shortest year in some ways. And then other ways, it's kind of like, I don't remember anything before this.
Yeah, 100%.
What have you been working on recently?
Just right now, I'm cleaning out this tape machine over here and digging into the cards and cleaning all the contacts, and not very exciting.
When you say tape machine, are you talking about like your recording tape machine?
Yeah.
Is that the, you use a, what do you use, a Tascam 388 or something like that?
Yeah, it's a little assortment of Tascam gear over here, mostly like 75% working.
Very cool. Yeah, I'm sure it's nice to have normal setup kind of going through as you're writing music. I think I said this to you maybe when we were talking, but I just found out about your music really in 2020 because I saw you play with Slim down in the Dominican, just happened to be there.
Oh, yeah.
And then came back, and then Slim put out the first little bit with the Strawberry Mansion stuff that he was doing. And then I was like, oh, who's this guy? I really got to look at this guy. That guy was awesome when we saw him. I was pretty drunk that week, though. I was right.
It was weird not to be drunk there.
Yeah. Well, I had become like kind of a bad alcoholic over the last 6 years or so. And it had kind of culminated in ending in that trip, which then I just stayed drunk for a couple of weeks after I got back and finally got sober, like a week and a half after I got back from that trip.
Yeah. Yeah. That was the last show pre-pandemic, which makes it even stranger to come back from DR. And then the world really changed while we were there. Like, I got the news that South By was canceled. And
oh, yeah. While you were there, I got that news.
It's a strange last memory of tour to have, be in this place that I had never been before. And
yeah, it was a surreal kind of setting. I remember my wife and I were coming back on the plane, and then there was this girl sitting by the window that was just extremely sick. And we were looking at each other going,
Wow.
Maybe we should have bought masks before we came out here. It was kind of like when, it was one of those things when we left, everybody was looking at me crazy because I was like, I don't know, maybe we should get like respirators and stuff just in case. And everybody's like being paranoid. And then by the time we got back, all that stuff was sold out.
Yeah, no kidding. I almost got stuck. I missed the flight back and I ended up spending some time in Puerto Rico, just like extra day. And in retrospect, it was a pretty close call because I think they started closing borders down right after that. I could be misremembering.
Yeah. But did you say that you weren't drinking down in the DR?
Yeah, I quit going on 2 years ago in May.
Congratulations.
And there's been a few moments where it hasn't really been, it's been hard, but not in the like, I really want to drink every day sense. But there have been a few moments where it seemed to, it didn't really make much sense not to be drinking. That was one of them. It's just the setting and the tone and yeah.
Yeah, no, March 12th was my 1 year.
Cool. Congrats.
Thanks. Yeah. And I go through times where I don't even think about it. And then I have like a moment where I'm around people, and like we went to this little socially distanced show the other day and everybody was just kind of having a good time and drinking. And I had like a coffee and I was watching this show. And I was like, it would be nice, but I guess that's just not something I'm allowed to do because that's not my MO to just be able to have a nice evening out of it.
Mm, yeah, it was a sharp learning curve. I ended up smoking a lot the first couple of months and kind of got maxed out on that and stopped. But yeah, takes some time.
It's a tough road for a lot of us, I guess. So anyway, what I was saying was I found out about your music from Slim playing with you and then having you on the album. And so then I started downloading your music and then just went on this binge. And then I talked with Paul and I was telling him, and then as I was looking at his album, I was like, oh, he's on this one. And so I mentioned it to him and that's how he got us connected. So
I'm glad he did. You're in Nashville?
No, I'm in Denver.
Oh, yeah. I'm sorry. Sometimes I lapse on major details.
No. It would make sense. I mean, 90% of the people I seem to interview these days are from Nashville.
Yeah, it's a home away from home.
Yeah. But you were born in Franklin, Virginia?
Franklin County, yeah.
Franklin County. Okay. Yeah. You lived there until you were about 10 or so?
Yeah, 10. I went out to California with my mom.
Okay.
Bay Area mostly.
And was your dad still back in Virginia at that time, or did...
Yeah, he's still there. He's still in Roanoke area.
When you moved to California when you were 10, I know your band's name is Twain. Would that have been about a time when you would start reading like Mark Twain books as a kid?
I never really read him before.
No?
No. I have some books on the shelf, but I don't know. My buddy gave me that name in high school, and it was a little band that ended up not coming into fruition, and I never lost the name. Yeah.
It's humorous. He didn't even know you could grow that amazing mustache at the time either.
Oh man. Yeah. I had to stop doing the mustache because it was a little on the nose. But
is that where the mustache came from and kind of doing that a little bit of a tribute, or did you just have the amazing mustache and it just,
or like synchronistically because of the name?
Yeah. Yeah. Not everybody gets that
coincidence.
Thick top part like that. You know, I got the full beard. It can go pretty big, but I just don't get that mustache like that.
You're not missing anything. It's kind of more maintenance than anything.
Originally, you were playing the mandolin, or did you play guitar before that? Or did you always kind of start off playing a lot of different instruments?
I learned piano first. Yeah, classical piano. Or I tried to study that as a little kid.
Mm-hmm.
And didn't have much patience, but that was how I was introduced to music. And then I had a really great accordion teacher in the eighth grade, this fellow called Henri Duchamp. He was a math teacher at my school. Oh, he would play for us. We would do these like PSAT practice sessions, and he would play the accordion for us. And he played really beautifully, gypsy music, Moldavian music. He was a really eclectic dude. I think he played on a Mr. Bungle album.
Oh, wow.
He had a song, Ars Moriendi. He told me about recording that. So I took some lessons with him because I had my father's accordion somehow. And that kind of cracked the egg into getting to other instruments and playing in bands as I got into high school.
Did you go to Marin Academy, which is like a prep school?
Marin, yeah.
That's out in the Bay Area, right?
Yeah, in Santa Fe, California.
How did that come about? Or is that just close to where you were living?
Was in the area, and I just kind of wound up there. I had some friends in middle school who were applying and, you know, gave it a shot and got in. And I'm glad that I did. There was really great music happening there. Good confluence of minds. I'm still in touch with three or four of the fellas that I played with, and they've all gone on to really awesome bands. My buddy Taylor is in the band Turquoise. You may have heard of. They're a really incredible funk band. Sam Doors went on to make the Deslons.
Okay, that was the Deslons connection.
Yeah, yeah. Jordan Hyde's playing in Ray for Riff Raff. Like, everyone found a way into these really different scenes. And it's been cool.
Eventually, you got onto the mandolin, or what drove you to go to Berkeley?
I was feeling pretty aimless. I was living in San Diego at the time, and yeah, I played some mandolin. They had just opened that up as a discipline, and I figured I had better chance to get in. Yeah, so I submitted some audition as mandolin fellow and ended up going to there.
When you were there, what band were you in while you were in Berkeley?
Well, I played in Turquoise a little bit. I was a keyboard player back in the day. And I also played in really great bands, which is Project of Annie Lynch, Ken and Alex Spaulding, Ken being the bass player in Twain.
Would the Low Anthem have been playing in the area just as like a local band at that time? Were you in school?
That's so amazing. They would play at the Billy Beard clubs like Lizard Lounge, Toad. I still remember those shows, even back when it was Ben and Jeff's duo. He was incredible. Hard to describe.
You got to join them in 2009?
My timeline is really foggy, so this is good for me, yeah.
That's fine. If I just say dates, just like, unless you hear something that you completely know, just go on.
No, it's really helpful.
My wife and I always do like a little wrap up after the show, and I usually double check myself on all the stupid shit that I just throw out, because I like to just make stuff up as I go along sometimes.
Apparently I do too, yeah, as a habit. Yeah, I'm working on that, but I have a lot of vague recollections of facts and data that I pick up along the way, and I'm not careful, I think they kind of stray and mutate.
Yeah, well, my mind is kind of like this just big box of liner notes, and so then I just sometimes I interwine things together.
Well, in good company.
How did you go from being a fan of the Low Anthem to then joining the band?
We played a lot of shows as the Beekeepers with them. So we were all friends. And have you heard of this group, The Blank Tapes? That's Matt Adams out of LA.
I mean, it sounds familiar, but it starts sounding like a lot of other things. So
he's really cool. I was playing with him on a European tour where I was the drummer. And that's when I got the call from Low Anthem to meet them in Europe, as it happened. And it was really serendipitous because we were all really broke and they helped me get home, actually. Ended up touring with them for a couple of years.
While you were playing with them, you started playing with Spirit Family Reunion. Was that just a timing thing where one was touring and the other one wasn't, or how did that come about?
Yeah, I had been playing with them prior to that European trip.
Okay.
And we had done maybe a couple East Coast tours and jumped into Low Anthem too, and they were really busy. So those years ended up being pretty much, I don't know, 10 or 11 months out of the year touring. And it was a strain for sure, but was getting so much out of that experience and playing both those groups. And that's a hard thing to have. Too much for one day or 1 year, but I guess a good problem to have. I definitely learned a lot about what is possible to do at once during that time.
And so you started writing music back in high school or early high school?
Yeah.
And at that time, were you writing on the piano and singing, or just writing for yourself, or had that original process of beginning to write work?
I can't really remember that. I played on piano and guitar a lot, and I was given a multi-track recorder, I think it had a CD drive in it, and that's what I started to record on. And I think that's when I really got into writing, like writing through recording more than write and play songs out. But I was really, really shy of that experience, so I got more out of, I guess, recording for myself and arranging too, starting around that time.
Yeah, I'm 41 and I'm still shy to that experience.
Yeah.
I've just recently been writing again. I just kept being like, well, I suck. I'm terrible self and everything that I do. And then every once in a while, somebody hear me and they're like, oh, whose is that? And I'm like, oh, mine. And they'd be like, oh, that's really good. Okay. Oh, that's just one person. Everybody else is good. We're our own worst enemy sometimes.
Yeah, it's good to check in with that voice from time to time.
No, I've been checking in with that voice a lot lately. Then as you started to write your own music, and then you started to play Beekeepers and then Low Anthem and Spirit Family Reunion, but you had already started your, I guess, solo project as Twain prior to all of that, or would it have gone all the way back to high school?
I went to college for 1 year in Southern California in Redlands, and that's where I first made a set of recordings and called it Twain, and I made a CD and stuff.
And then you did Sleeping Tree and the Almanac. Were you in Boston at that time?
Yeah, in Alston.
And so now I'm going to pick all the wrong bands that I think you sound similar to in my mind and inspire me.
Yeah.
And then you go, nope, no, I don't even like them. I hate them. Or no, they didn't inspire me.
I'll probably just embarrass myself by not knowing who some of them are.
No, I'm going to horribly embarrass myself by like naming random people that most people won't know who they are. Just kidding. But when I first heard your songs, I was trying to do the thing that we do and connect it to something else. I don't know why humans do that, because everybody's their own voice, but I was talking to Slim about it, but it's like you hear somebody that you admire or appreciate, and then you want to know who the people are that inspired them, and you kind of go rabbit hole backwards so you can make that connection. But there's definitely, I felt like some older Lou Reed, Velvet Underground, maybe hints and undertones somewhere.
I love them. I'm flattered that you hear that in there. That's one of those bands that, like, I get the rock and roll syndrome a lot when I listen to. And yeah, I don't know. I want to know what that feels like to make music like that. And I don't know. I don't know what they were feeling, but yeah, it's enchanting.
Yeah. Well, I'm going to make you feel embarrassed for a second, but I think your music's pretty enchanting. So
thanks.
No problem. Another one, which kind of has a second layer to it. Back when I was in college, I went to University of Georgia in Athens.
Okay.
And there was like the Elephant Six bands were real big at that time. I don't know if you know any of those, like Neutral Milk Hotel and Olivia Tremor Control.
Yeah, I know Neutral Milk Hotel. Okay. I've heard of Olivia Tremor Control, but I never listened to their records.
Well, Olivia Tremor Control was one of the ones that I was going to say. I mean, even though Jeff, there could be some similarities there in some different ways, but Olivia Tremor Control always had this like thing in the background that made me think of somewhere between like if the Beach Boys and the Beatles got in a band together and played, and there was some sounds of what that would be, that they kind of had some of those mixes and with the trippy ears of the Beatles. And I was just wondering if, as far as mainstream bands, if like Beach Boys and Beatles had been in your wheelhouse as people that you were looking up to and listening to.
Yeah, big time. I think that started the path for me, particularly the Beatles, but of course getting into like Pet Sounds and some of that era of Brian Wilson a little bit later.
Everybody gets there eventually, right?
Yeah, you got to. And then finding out about, you know, all the people who played on those sessions and how ubiquitous they were. It's really cool. I love how enmeshed that scene was. Kind of hard-pressed for examples, but just get that feeling of real community behind so many of those albums.
Did you ever hear the band Love?
Oh yeah, I love that band.
There was something one of the first times I heard you, and it made me want to go listen to Love after I got done. And there was some moments where I was like, I was right. This has that feel, or that's what I felt.
Yeah, that record, that and around that time, I was getting into this album by The Move called Shazam, which I feel like sounds a lot like. I just listened to Forever Changes. I didn't have a whole bunch of their records, but
yeah, me too. That was the first one that I got, and a friend gave it to me on like a copied cassette. It was actually, I was living in Japan, and he gave it to me on a copied mini disc player.
Where did you live in Japan?
Tokyo.
Okay, cool.
So those are the influences that I felt. So at least you knew of the music.
Oh yeah, no, you got my wheelhouse there. Yeah. I love all those bands.
And as you've been going on and kind of creating the style and recording analog, it gives it that touch of either Paul and I were talking the other day about indie music, and it's kind of like the joke of like what indie music is. But there was something that people were driving for originally, which was that just kind of sense of raw and real, like where it was something visceral about like the way you could almost touch the music, you know, feel it. And I remember the first time I heard one of your albums, I was hearing that just kind of in the background. I had my headphones on, and then I listened to the next one. And I was like, it's there again, there again. And it's, and then I found out you recorded on those Tascams, and I don't know. There's something about it that gives it that feeling where, I don't know, it's like the common man music or something. Like it feels real. It feels like you could be a part of that. I don't know. There's something special about that.
Yeah. I think I hear what you're saying. I don't know what it is. And I feel like everyone has pinpointed the not obvious. I don't want to be another guy singing the praises of the tape machine redundantly, but the difference, I guess, is like being in a room versus being outside. And you're in a room and the tape machine, and being outside in the digital realm where you have no ceiling, no limit, infinite space. Versus like a built-in context of the tape machine. And I think that's why they both are so different, and such great music can happen in both realms. And maybe for illustrating like a guy in a room or a really one voice, it helps to be confined by the space of the tape. But I don't know. I think both mediums can kind of do the same place, just through a different path.
Yeah. No, I agree. And it's just kind of one of those things where do you need to have the pieces in place and understand that it's kind of finite, or are you somebody that likes to have a gazillion ingredients around you and then see if you can put something together?
Yeah. Yeah, and correct mistakes and go back in time versus committing to each step for better or for worse. And it can be like, I get real lazy about that because you just can't fix mistakes or things that you decide are mistakes. And I think that's beautiful, but also it can lead to a lack of discipline or just, you know, there's nothing I can do about this. So this is how the record will be. So it's good and bad, I guess.
Yeah. I don't know. I guess that you could look at it in a couple of different ways. You could look at it like laziness, but I would also say there's some more diligence. It's just where you're putting that emphasis, whether it's before or after, you know?
Yeah. Yeah. I didn't mean that it necessitates laziness, but yeah, the potential is definitely there. Yeah.
I used to be a DP, and so when I was shooting film, I really liked it, but you could end up with a product that was much harder to fix or unfixable.
Is that director of production?
Director of photography. So like cinematographer. So like the person on a film set that is in charge of the camera crew and the grip crew and the lighting crew. I was working in indie film and indie TV. So at the time I was also usually the camera operator, but then I also, you know, worked with the lighting crew and the grip crew and told them what my vision was or just literally lit the stuff myself, depending on how small the films or TV shows were.
Cool.
But I was at that era where HD was just starting to kind of come in. And so it was kind of 50-50 shooting film or shooting HD. And I usually liked working with directors a lot more when you were shooting film or if they were more used to shooting film, because there was a lot more thought that went in on the front end. That was just my own interpretation.
Yeah, I think that applies to music production too.
I'm going to kind of go back a little bit. In 2017, you came out with Rare Feeling. In case you didn't know, it was 2017. I was just giving you an update.
I would have been maybe said 18.
Yeah, well, that was probably when you were having to promote it a lot.
Yeah, it did have like stages of coming out.
Sure. And then when Rare Feeling came out, I mean, just from on my end of going back and looking at, it really seemed like you were starting to get kind of a lot behind you at that point. Was that because you had first started, because you had gotten onto a company here in the US and over in the UK at the same time for that album, right?
Like onto a label?
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. It was the first time for both. Up to then, I had just been putting things out myself, and Keeled Scales picked up the record kind of after I did a little self-release, and they helped me find a label out in Europe called BB Island. And yeah, that was a whole new phase for me.
And you seem to do quite a bit, I guess, of press, more than maybe you had done before and even after, it seems. Is that based off of your own non-love for getting yourselves into situations like this, or was that just kind of how it was at the time, just kind of a series of events?
Both getting over being real arrogant about what I needed and accepting some help. And yeah, I also am kind of phobic of looking at that stuff, so I don't have a good sense of how it was released, but
right. So you don't even know what was out there. Yeah.
And I feel badly about that in retrospect. Like I'm trying to take a more active and appreciative role in what's going on, because folks are working. And yeah, it's been a struggle to get over these hangups and be present. And it's a lot easier to just do the thing and check out and hope that it will get its own legs. But trying to get over that.
Yeah, no, I completely understand, because I have a real kind of, I had or have a little bit of a hang up with like social media and some of those things.
I'm so afraid of it.
Yeah, I'm afraid of it. Don't really like it. You know, well, I've had my moments, but I liked MySpace back in the day, but it was in the periphery. It wasn't like a real big part of my life, but I could go onto a person's page and check out, oh, who's your favorite top three bands or whatever, you know, like, and that was pretty much it. You'd go on and like go to people's pages and listen to what music was out there. And that sometimes was a way to find new music. Like that was actually one of the ways that I used it.
Same here.
I stayed on that for a long time until there was nobody left on it.
Yeah.
And then they were like, you got to be on Facebook. And I was like, I don't want to change. Why do I want to go to Facebook? And they're like, well, it's MySpace, but it's more grown up. And I'm like, well, then I definitely don't want to be on that. Like, that sounds terrible.
There was a time when people said that Facebook was grown up.
Yes.
Wow.
Yes. This was I mean, I got it from multiple people telling me that I needed to grow up and get on Facebook.
Yeah.
That MySpace was for kids. And I was probably, I don't know, maybe 30 years old at that time or late 20s. I'm 41 now. So yeah, I've probably been like my late 20s or early 30s when I switched over. And I don't know. So then I got onto this stuff and then I was like, I don't like this. I got onto Facebook and I was like, it's just people talking about politics and, you know, all this crap that I don't want to hear. So I got off Facebook and then I found Instagram, which at first was pretty pictures, but then eventually it kind of grew. And I was like, I don't really like this anymore. But I did learn that it was kind of that way to find music again, because you could go and follow your artists, and most of the artists that I, you know, listened to were on Instagram. So then you could find other music and people promoted stuff. And so that was the kind of one that I've stuck with. But doing this show, literally, what way am I to get out there in the world other than social media?
Sure. Yeah.
And then you start talking about it, and then you start talking about yourself, and then it just becomes this kind of gross, you know, self-indulgence of talking about yourself. Mm. It's a real nasty cycle.
Yeah. We're all walking around in each other's egos out there.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know. I really admire people who have a sense of humor and can be light about it and honest. And I don't know, I just, I really get in my mind and get freaking out about like contexts that I'm not thinking about when I say something, anything. It seems like if you think about any statement long enough, you can figure out a way that someone would misinterpret it. And makes it tough.
It does. And I think that that's part of it too, is that now you put anything out there, and if you say something and then later on there's that criticism of what you said 10 years ago, because either you were dumb or misinformed at the time or whatever. And then somebody's like, well, we've got it. You said this 10 years ago and that's what you said. So that's what you mean now, 10 years later. And it's like, no, I've grown and changed a lot in the last 10 years. And it's like, nope, you said this. It's on record.
Yeah. There's not enough time in a million universes to let everyone explain themselves and I answer questions. And I think, yeah, I feel that we're all like struggling underneath the weight of so much information. Just every day it's exponentially more. And I don't know, that sounds like your experience. Or
for sure, I do. As you're going through and kind of navigating this new world, because you've been doing this for a while now, when you were first getting started with your bands, I'm guessing maybe, like I said, MySpace was just kind of starting to become a thing where, yeah, we'll put up a song or something on MySpace and then...
Yeah. Also, do you remember the one that there was like a bunch of people on the board, including George Martin, and it was like this carousel where you submit a song and it goes around and people can like up or down tick it. And then eventually it was actually so neat. Like the evaluation part of it, that thing was cool. And I remember finding like so much neat music. And also the people who were on there were not harsh. Like there was a lot of great criticism. And if someone disliked something, they would, I just remember like people being really intelligent. And if they didn't like your thing, they would say why. And I feel like weirdly that was such a source of education for me. I can't remember what the thing is called, but
thinking about that now, like people are just nasty. I don't know if I'd even call them music critics. They're just people with thoughts that decide to critique music. When people destroy an album, it makes me kind of sick to my stomach a little bit, because I know that everybody out there, most of the time, unless there's some kind of performance art aspect of it, are out there trying to make good music that they like. They're putting out their heart and soul into something that they like, and they may be really insecure about it. And then they put it out into the world and then have some asshole like tell them, you know, tear them apart.
I'm curious where you're finding negative music reviews, because I feel like almost universally I find like, or I like maybe people are not even doing this anymore, like the negative criticism, but
I find it sometimes, but maybe I'm in the wrong places.
No, that's, I mean, I don't think there's anything wrong with it as long as, yeah, it's constructive and suggesting something that could improve or that could be done differently. And I mean, I want it personally. Like I would love for someone to honestly tell me what they're missing from the experience, or like tell me things that they receive from lyrics that they didn't find to be right or true or helpful. Or yeah, I miss that, especially in this pandemic year, of at least we would get that from our peers. And yeah,
I think that's a lot of time, that's, you know, that sense of community and the stuff we get from our peers. It can be some of the hardest critiques to take, but at the same time, it's some of the best. Sometimes it's hard for somebody outside, somebody that really knows you, to understand what's worth critiquing or not.
Mm.
You released an album in 2020. At what time of the year was that?
I think it was in June.
So was that something you had been recording for a while coming up to it? Or was that some of the stuff you recorded during or post-pandemic?
It was, I think, the months of March and April of 2020. Yeah.
So I've talked to a bunch of different people that have, you know, it's kind of seemed to gone one way or the other, where people really dove into music or withdrew them. So you were somebody that it definitely inspired to get down and write, but that's kind of been your history, I guess, a little bit, right? That you can kind of take from whatever the current thing is and delve into it, whether positive or negative, or if you felt that in your writing experience.
I don't know about that. I could definitely get real blocked up, and then a lot of times there will be some kind of trigger event. Maybe it's a breakup, or maybe when there was touring, I would get inspired touring a lot. Mm-hmm. Just feel like a lot of movement. And yeah, obviously last year was almost nothing left to be said about how crazy it was. And I felt pretty sane throughout a lot of it, because I tend to be a hermit, is a nice way of putting it, but really more like a shut in. And so a lot of the experience of being at home wasn't that crazy. But I think subconsciously I was having a lot of the same fears that everyone was having, and I was making that record as a way of feeling like I can connect to my old life. I can maybe connect to this thing that sustains me, and it just felt like a kind of a survival feeling. And I really love that album. It's also the first thing that I recorded myself that wasn't at Montrose Recording in Richmond. Yeah. Which is why it sounds so much worse on the fidelity side. But it brought me back to being like 17 in the garage and like learning Pro Tools Lite or whatever came with Mbox, and like getting lost and working on one instrument sound for so long. And I'm not that patient anymore, but I was really special feeling to get in tune with again.
It's a great album. I love it. But
thanks.
I read that you were working on some kind of prose, or like maybe some kind of book in connection with some of your older writings, or maybe poetry. Is that correct?
I might have said that I was, but I didn't really start yet. Really,
haven't gotten there yet. Okay.
Yeah. I was mostly just going to make a lyric book.
Okay.
And like close. I feel like ending a big phase of my music life and human life, and kind of thinking about like big picture and like how do I want this body of work to look, and was dividing it into like big categories, like just like ended this morning of my life, and sort of like making a little book that's just all of the lyrics and then any pieces of writing extra that felt relevant and like someone might actually want to read. And but it's taken a long time to figure out how to format that and how to make it nice.
Yeah. I think in my mind I had pictured like a fictional narrative story that somehow interwove like bits and pieces of your song lyrics and poems into this person's life, and I was like, oh, that's gonna be intense.
I'm no writer. I wish that maybe later down the road.
I think you're a pretty good writer. Going back to something that I guess might be a little bit different, back when you were writing Rare Feelings, you had a song that you kind of dedicated to, I think it was on Rare Feelings, Andrew Lewis.
Yeah.
And he was murdered?
Yeah.
Are you able to talk about that, or you want to move on to something else?
Well, I don't know how much much want to go into that. I mean, I don't know how much I can truthfully say because I don't know what happened, and no one does, seemingly.
Okay.
Yeah. But out of sensitivity to the folks, or maybe. Yeah. Well, it's mostly that I feel like it was a really mysterious situation, and I don't know how to speak about it accurately. But in terms of the song, it wasn't written about Andrew, but that happened, and then it just changed, and we became a place to think about him.
No, and that's an aspect that I definitely understand, is that songs for us as listeners, and then as musicians, they can change over time. Because when you write a song, and there may be one person in your life, and then that person may be gone, and then you sing that song later on, it's not that you didn't write it in a certain interpretation of what that time is, but now that's not what it says to you. And I mean, I was kind of a hopeless romantic and just kept going through series of like these longer term relationships that I thought were going to be the one that it's kind of like life, you know, where you're looking over the hill and you think you're almost to the end of the mountain, and then turns out it's just another little mountain on the way up, and you just keep going. So I just was this kind of hopeless romantic. And I remember going through like three or four different women that I'd just be madly in love with, and I'd hear a song and, you know, whatever it was. And at that time, that's the song that was for them. You know, maybe it had been for somebody else before, but changes over time.
Sure. Yeah. I think it's okay. I mean, I think it's okay too to have the opposite experience of different experiences being unified into a single one. What am I trying to say even? I think this is something about songs that is really so powerful that it takes whatever that unnameable abstraction about an experience that everyone has a different version of, and makes a location for it that you can go to. And that's how writing has been for me anyway, of like combining feelings about different people and about different selves that I've been into a single identity. I don't know. I'm sorry. I feel like I just got off the rails.
No, that's actually, that was thought that was pretty poignant. And maybe I misinterpreted what you're saying, but like even life, we kind of, you know, we talked about memory and you get things kind of jumbled up. And you kind of, things in your life that inspire you kind of come from a couple of different things. And you may be thinking you're taking it from one thing, or you're taking it from a series. You know, we're not like a binary kind of force. You know, everything's coming from many different ways. So in storytelling, a lot of what we do is we're taking combinations of things, and it may be based, you know, there may be a lot off of one spot, but there's a couple of things from here and a couple of things from there. Maybe like that. Is that kind of in line with what you were saying?
Yeah, definitely. No. I think it represents something that's missing. And oh man, I need to put the soapbox away. I'm sorry. I feel like I was about to get on there.
Go soapbox. This show's a soapbox. It's cool.
I just hear the what this world needs speech coming on. I'm going to refrain.
What the world needs.
that's really the answer.
Yeah. Change? No, I'm just kidding. I couldn't help myself.
It's going to change.
Yeah, it is. So talking about that and kind of gaining from different experiences, I kind of brought up some of the inspirational people in my life that I, you know, rudely projected onto your music, or maybe in this case, it wasn't too bad. I didn't do as bad as I do sometimes. Sometimes I do good, sometimes I do bad. Do you have any people that you really respected, you know, that you feel, not that you're stealing from or in any way, because I don't think it's possible in music, but that you really were drawing from as you were originally doing your songwriting and has kind of developed into it's a unique style. And though you've definitely, you can hear the progression over the years of the albums, there's something about it that was very strongly there in the beginning that is still a very cohesive part of it. Like I feel like a big chunk of it, and like maybe it's emotion and soul and whatever it is, but I feel like it's the way you sing. It's a kind of passion that has not changed since the earlier works. Are there people that you were drawing on back then that you were really inspiring you, or was it just a huge amalgamation? Were you just a music nerd and just taken from everywhere?
thank you for the compliment. And yeah, definitely. So many, especially when I first started to fall in love with music, just devouring records all the time. And I think, I don't know even where to begin, but it was always the feeling of like hearing someone activated. And I just can't describe it maybe in any other way. And it's in everything, like in every kind of art or speech, like when you hear someone just talking in a public place, like, and suddenly they're activated. Like, I don't know how else to say it. Like they're extra alive or vivacious, or it's not just people doing social dance. Like it's someone is, you can tell they're like really hearing themselves, like almost from outside of their own being in a mm-hmm. way. And that's, I guess, how I describe it. Like a few times you get to contact that feeling. And it's, I think it's just like, I'm really, really being me right now. And that's what I try to chase writing or playing. And I think that for me, I think I can feel it when other people are doing it too. So it leads me to believe that this is like an experience that we can all have. And that when someone's experiencing that, other people can feel it. And it helps. It helps other folks, like it helped me, to find it for themselves. You know, does that make any sense?
It does. Yeah, I was just trying to kind of think back to those first teenage years when I was going to like live music and having that yeah. experience when it just hits you and you're just like, holy shit. And you know, it could be at like a rock concert or it could be with classical music, but for me, I always got literally the chill bumps.
Mm, yeah, yeah.
Like I'd have that moment in a show where it was like, I'd feel it and you would feel just the presence coming off the person on stage and they could be doing a solo acoustic, whatever. Or it could be like, you know, some band just really getting into it and kind of coming into some big kind of climax into a show. And I don't know, gives you this feeling. But like you say, yeah, just hearing somebody speak who can do that. I think that's how cult leaders, you know, get people on board.
Sure. Yeah. Unfortunately, it's kind of its own energy and it has all sorts of different results depending on who it inhabits. But I think there's like a cumulative effect too, or like thinking about shows that I've been at where this feeling enters the crowd. Kind of time stretchy feeling. Mm-hmm. I think that's something so precious about a show is that it's a little easier to acquiesce to it when there's a lot of other folks around or when you feel the cumulative energy of a bunch of people versus like, I'm going to put this record on alone at home and try to surrender to it and truly hear what's going on. But it's really possible in that setting too, I think.
Yeah. Yeah. It's definitely interesting. Without the feedback of the crowd. And, you know, if I like a band, I'll just go see them over and over and over again if they're around. And you go to a show one night where they're playing like a soft, like quiet moment in the set. And there's still a lot of, you know, woo, you know, like in the middle of everybody in the place is quiet. And then two or three, woo, and you're just like, okay, not my choice. I'm trying to have empathy and compassion and all these things, but I'm feel like the blood get going a little bit. But then you go to another night and like in those moments, like when a band goes, and it can be like a band that's going kind of back and forth from rock, or it can be a band that plays kind of continually slowly, but there's just that moment where everybody kind of gets together and they're just all tuned in. People aren't chit-chatting and there's no woo. And
yeah,
it's an, I don't know. I love that feeling.
Yeah. Yeah. I don't know. I think it can happen with the chit-chatting and the...
It can too, yeah.
And the woos and like, and the chaos too. It's good. Like, if anything, I have a lot of memories of the last year of touring, of kind of struggling with like a pretty oppressive stillness and like not knowing if it's because there's nothing I'm doing getting across, or like it sometimes feels like it's just real. It's like a lot of consciousness, collective self-awareness in the room, and it's hard to break through it for me too, big time, because I'm so tied up in my own mind. And that started to feel like the challenge itself. It's like, how do we, like, I mean, it's cool if it's going to be totally silent, but
how do you get the feedback and know that the
or just to get things vibrate a little bit.
Yeah, I can see that on the one side or the other.
Yeah.
Play a raucous tune.
That's when the rock and roll syndrome comes in for me.
So about how far back did you start playing with Slim or Sean? Do you call him Sean or Slim?
Both. Yeah,
okay.
But I then been working with a publisher whose name is also Sean, and I've been accidentally texting Sean messages for Slim, which tend to be like encoded with the weird humor.
Yeah.
So then calling him Slim more. But I started to tour to open for him like 2017 or I don't know, yeah, years. I think the first record we made together was 2018, which is The Lost at Last. And then that turned into like a band, and that album was kind of intended to be more of a like a folk or like a solo record. And the band kind of morphed into this like, I think more like psychedelic country, like country rock band. Maybe not really so much in the country's realm, but like the band is so cool. And we started playing a lot of festivals. And
I think I saw you guys on that tour at, you guys do the like Vail Games. It was this weird thing at like the Ford Theater up in Vail. You guys were, I think you were, I think you were there. Now that I think about it, I think I remember you on stage now. Only reason I probably remember is because I took the month of June off as sober. I was trying to like get myself under control so I didn't have to quit drinking forever. Mm. And that was like a sober month. So I happened to be sober. And I'm pretty sure it was the Lost at Last band.
Yeah.
And then were you working on the Lost at Last Volume 2?
Yeah, we made that in Louisiana. That still hasn't come out.
Right. And then Strawberry Mansion, did you just happen to be in Nashville at the time when he went in to go make that record? Did he call you up?
No, I went up there. That was last summer. And it was right after making that album, Days of Effort and Ease, we were talking about. And I was going through a breakup here in Austin, and we were entering like the heavy lockdown, and things were just, it was just a hard time to be here. And that record was really lucky for me to go hang out with some buds and play music. And it was just Sean and Paul and I in Paul's studio, Daylight. And it was really sweet and brotherly, and like felt like doing some cool experiments, and everyone was wearing hats that are new to them. Yeah, it was really nice.
And did you know Paul prior to that?
Yeah, I knew Paul from touring together, because he played on the first Lost at Last, and then we played at least a year of shows, maybe probably more, before Jeff came and started playing bass, and Paul kind of shifted more into focusing on his studio and on production. Yeah.
Very cool. Yeah, I'd forgotten that point, that Paul had played on that and then toured off that for a bit.
That feels like a really long time ago somehow. Well, it's weird that later things feel more recent. I'm sorry, not that later things, but previous things feel.
Yeah, I knew. That's funny, because I didn't even think about what you said. I knew exactly what you meant. Well, very cool. So you've got your new newish album out, which is still fairly fresh. Are you planning to get out and play live here later in the year? Do you have anything that's set up that's tentative when things come back? Or are you kind of waiting and seeing?
Nothing is on the books, and I don't know. I mean, some tours with my friends. Buck Meek is going to be touring. I play in his band. That's in October. And then actually just set up a show with Courtney Marie Andrews in Nashville this month on 22nd April, which will be the first show I've played. I played one show during the pandemic, but I don't know what's going on. We just finished another record that's getting mixed today, actually. We started yesterday, and yeah, Adrian's in Richmond mixing songs, so maybe that comes out in the fall or end of the year. And
where'd you guys record that?
That's also at Montrose.
It was. And then it's being mixed up there?
Yeah.
Okay. So you were up in Virginia.
Yeah. I went there in October to do that. And also, do you know Michael Now?
I know the name.
Yeah. Check out Michael Now. He's so amazing.
Does he have another name that he goes?
Cotton Jones. This is older band. And Also Paige Francis.
It was Cotton Jones. I knew that it was. Yeah.
Mike's a hero. And we got to do some recording bookended to that session together.
Aggravated with me for asking this, but is there anything else that you want to promote that I haven't talked about? Or is there any kind of advice or words you have for the world? Yeah, now's your time to do your soapbox if you
want to. I want to mention my friend Jolie Holland put together with a group called Abolition Apostles this virtual concert. Okay, yeah, I wanted to talk about this concert called Abolition 2021. It's happening 4 days in April, the 9th, the 16th, the 23rd, and the 30th. And what it is a fundraiser for a hospitality house outside of Angola prison in Louisiana. And this would be a place that family members of the incarcerated can come, as well as lawyers and activists and reporters. And it's a really beautiful cause. And the lineup is wildly good. A ton of really talented artists. So the website is called noonchorus.com. You can check out the tickets and dates.
Yeah. Did you say New Chorus? Like N-E-W?
Noon, like afternoon.
Noon. Okay. Yeah. Yeah. Shoot me that. I'll put it up in the show notes as well. And then I'll put it on the post for the episode. Cool. All right, man. Well, thanks for coming on and thanks for talking to me a little bit about some of your past and inspiration. And
definitely, man. Thank you for having me.
Appreciate it, man. But hopefully we'll stay in touch and catch up to each other in the real world when it all comes back together.
Cool.
All right, brother.
All right.
Thanks.
See you soon.
Bye. When you were young, you were the king of carrot flowers, and how you built a tower tumbling through the trees, and all the rattlesnakes that fell all around your feet.
Nope, no idea.
Hey, Crystal.
Hey.
How are you doing?
I just told you I'm tired and I'm mad. Okay. My emotions are valid, okay?
Yep. So today we're here to talk about Matt Davidson's episode, Twain.
Yes, which I did the weirdest thing today.
You looked him up.
No, I listened to the episode before I did my wrap up for it.
That's right. And so did a lot of other people.
Yeah. It's okay.
It's okay. Some of you.
I listened to it at the same time you guys did.
Hey guys, everybody that's getting to listen to this, just know that if you listen on the first day of the episode, which I really appreciate everybody that does, you may have missed this because this is being included on the second day of release.
This seems like a preaching to the choir moment in a like sort of backwardsy way. Like none of the people that listen to it today, which will, when this comes out, be yesterday, will know that you're saying that. Only the people that are literally listening to it today, which is now tomorrow.
Well, everybody else other than the people that listen to it on day one will know that this was not included on day one. However, I put it in the original introduction that it was going to be included on day two. So those people have the option to go back and listen to it.
I guess they could come back. If they want to hear my sunshiny voice be angry about recording something at 10 p.m.
Yes.
Who wouldn't sign up for that?
Exactly. I mean, I signed up for life. So anyway, moving on.
You sure did.
Matt Davidson, Twain. Who used to have just the biggest mustache in the world, but in very Mark Twain fashion, had a Mark Twain mustache, even though, as he said...
I'm sad that it sounds like it went away.
It did. Now he has that massive beard.
Okay.
When we saw him...
I'm a huge fan of mustaches.
God, I'm trying to remember back in Dominican if he had the big mustache too, or if he had gone beard at that point. I think he had a beard. But I think the first time you saw Langhorne Slim.
Which was in Vail.
Yes. I believe he had the big mustache at that time.
I don't remember because I apparently go unconscious when I listen to live music. I absorb it, but I don't remember a single thing that happened. I remember that Langhorne Slim wore overalls, but that is a pretty general statement.
was going to say, you were doing a sober June as well at that time.
I was. So that doesn't mean that I remember things better.
No, it doesn't.
I remember it existed, like it happened. I vaguely remember we were with a couple of my friends. And I remember that I had to go put the dog back in the car. Cut that part so it doesn't sound like I put my dog in the car.
Right. Okay, so
I remember that my dog could not attend that concert.
When Matt and I were talking and I was giving references to music that I thought were reminiscent of him, I was talking to Matt about Olivia Tremor Control and Neutral Milk Hotel of the Elephant Six, that Olivia Tremor Control had like some kind of mix of Beach Boys and Beatles, and that was where I was getting to because there was something about their style that I thought was reminiscent of Matt's in certain aspects, but it was more of their roots going into it. But anyway, Elephant Six Recordings, sometimes people called them the Elephant Six Collective. The main bands that I associated with them at the time were Apples in Stereo, Elf Power, Neutral Milk Hotel of Montreal, and Olivia Tremor Control. The original four members were Bill Doss, Will Cullen, Art Jeff Mangum, and Robert Schneider. And they moved from Ruston, Louisiana. And at the time, Athens, Georgia, where I went to school, seemed like a cool hip music town. So three of them moved to Athens, and they had a band that eventually came Olivia Tremor Control. And then Jeff Mangum started Neutral Milk Hotel on his own. And Robert Schneider moved to Denver, which we live in Denver, so that's connected. So now
All
of the Elephant Six groups. But so Elephant Six came it started out as their little group, but it grew to be this big group of bands. So it was part of this like collective.
Did they all just like tour together? Or
they would tour together, and then they eventually started Elephant Six Recordings. But I was talking about Olivia Tremor Control, and then today I thought about a story where the bass player of Olivia Tremor Control worked at Wuxtree Records in Athens. And as an uneducated indie rock kid getting into the scene, I went in one day and asked for a CD. And I believe it was Super Furry Animals. And I asked the bass player, and I did not know it was the bass player of Olivia Tremor Control at the time. I knew he was recognizable, but I just thought he was Athens. I saw townies all the time that I was used to. And he went and showed me all these different bands that he thought that I should look into after finding out whatever band it was that I came to him. And then I remember I went back to the coffee shop where I worked, and I was like, oh, that guy was so nice. He like showed me all this different stuff. And somebody was like, oh, that was the bass player for Olivia Tremor Control. And then Super Furry Animals. Did you ever listen to Super Furry Animals?
You can't see this at home, but I'm side cocking my head and rolling my eyes because he knows what I listen to as a young person. And he knows that was not it.
They were this Welsh like indie rock band.
Oh, yeah. That totally sounds like my jam in high school.
But he would sing in English most of the time, but they did do an album where they sang all in Welsh, which was really, it's a really crazy, it's not something you hear very often.
Really? I said, it's part of my regular repertoire of music.
Well, Welsh, like people, you hear people speak English with a Welsh accent, but you don't hear people speak Welsh very often. I think that's just been my own personal experience. But Gruff Reese was in Super Furry Animals. And then when I lived in LA the second time, I went to go see this band Neon Neon do a CD release party or album release party. And Gruff Reese was in that band as well. And I think I had gone to see some girl to go with her to this show, or somehow she had got me in. And then she ended up not being a part of the picture. And I don't know what happened. But I ended up going and ended up hanging out with some people that were managing this event or whatever. And they invited me to this after party, this other bar. And I ended up getting to hang out with Gruff Reese of Super Furry Animals and talk to him about a show that I saw in Tokyo where he threw radishes at the crowd.
Radishes?
Yeah, they have these big, they call them daikon. It's like this big, like...
But why radishes?
He didn't recall even throwing the radishes or having the radishes.
Okay. I feel like radishes would be like, they'll leave a dent in your head if you throw them hard enough.
Well, he was just like tossing them to the crowd. Okay. He had a bunch of these.
So we're not like chucking baseball size radishes.
He was like eating the radish at the beginning.
They're golf ball size.
So they did this cool thing when they started that show.
Now they made coleslaw and tossed it in the audience.
But it just, I was not going to go into this, but now I'm going to because you did this.
They did it.
They had a opening of the show.
Who's the guy with the watermelons?
Oh my God. Gallagher.
They did a Gallagher style opening event with sledgehammers and just radishes, just radish coleslaw for days.
He had like three radishes. He was eating one and he just tossed a couple to the crowd. It wasn't a
big
deal.
This is a thing that's not going away for me.
Okay. So, but they had...
Cancel the rest of the wrap up. We're going to talk about this.
Okay. So they had this cool thing because they had these screens on the background for like playing behind them at this show. They had a new album coming out, which I think it was called Rings Around the World. I'm not sure, but you see the band like walking up a flight of stairs.
Okay.
And we're at like a club, you know, there may have been a little basement area, but they start doing this thing and it seems like it's alive of them like walking to the stage. And so they walk up the flight of stairs and then they walk up another flight of stairs and this thing just keeps going on and on for like 5 or 10 minutes. I don't know where they filmed the them walking up the stairs, but it was not at that concert venue. It was not a live performance. So it was like some like, you know, 30 story building. So like they keep, you keep thinking that they're almost there.
They filmed it at the Sears Tower.
Yeah. And it was just, it was a kind of a cool effect because you're like, okay,
here they come.
Okay. Wait a second. And then I think they even did a thing where they started to go to a door, but then they like just keep going up the, and then they finally come on stage. But I thought that was pretty clever.
Not as clever as a Gallagher style radish explosion, but still pretty clever.
Super Furry Animals has nothing to do with this episode, but cool band back
yeah,
in the
day.
Yeah,
let's keep moving.
Jeff Mangum was the lead singer of Neutral Milk Hotel. And that was that King of Carrot Flowers part one that I was singing to you at the beginning.
Okay.
But they were probably one of my favorite bands in college. And they,
which makes sense as to why I've never heard that song before.
Okay. But he stopped playing right when I got into him. So I think his last big show in Athens was like the end of my first semester of school. And that was right about the time that I had just found Neutral Milk Hotel. So I was so excited to get to go see this new band that I'd found. My understanding later was he had kind of a nervous breakdown and he stopped playing and he became a recluse. And you would barely see him around town. It wasn't like a, and then
kind of like what you're doing now,
kind of like what I'm doing now. But I worked with this kid at the coffee shop that was in one of the indie bands in town. I can't remember what they were called, but he was a touring musician. And so he had come off tour and was working at this coffee shop where I was at. And his roommate was Jeff Mangum, or one of his roommates in this house. And I talked to him about my love for Jeff. He said that he still plays music and he's recording all the time. And he has a little 4-track that he always records on, and he just, his character kind of reminded me of Matt in a way, like in him always having his little Tascams. So I also have always called him Tascams, and okay, I wonder if that's a Georgia thing or if that's just a me being me thing.
Did you just find out as of today old that you have been pronouncing it wrong?
No, Matt, I didn't even look it up, but Matt pronounced it Tascam, and it was very clearly he enunciated like the ah.
Yeah, yeah.
And I always have called them Tascams. And so I'd read somewhere that Matt used a Tascam 388, but he said he used a series of Tascams. But I'm going to tell you about the 388. It's also called the Studio 8. And I found this like 1986 article where somebody was reviewing it, and it was kind of a ad, and also like had like a record producer or something reviewing like the system. But it was an integrated recorder. Jesus. The Tascam Studio 8 is an integrated recorder mixer which represents an interesting development of the Porta Studio concept. A quarter-inch reel-to-reel multi-track tape machine is housed alongside the comprehensively equipped 8-channel mixer in the substantial console, requiring only the addition of suitable monitoring to form a complete and quite sophisticated 8-track recording system. So the thing that was prior to this, like when I was growing up and people were recording music, you were lucky if your buddy had a 4-track recorder on this quarter inch system. But this was like supposed to be the new, like it's an 8-track system that is still portable, but it was kind of heavy as shit. It's not that portable, but it was portable.
portable by 1980 standards, when boomboxes fit comfortably on your shoulder.
But even I read some reviews in the 1980s and people were like, it's a little heavy to be considered a portable device.
Portable in the sense that you can put it in the trunk of your car.
Right. You could. I mean, I think, yeah, I think if I remember correctly, it was 37 pounds or something like that.
Dang, that's an entire bag of dog food.
I thought that was interesting.
No, Rush, we're not doing that.
You guys don't know, we listened to a podcast about Rush Limbaugh on...
The one I told you to listen to?
We listened to it together.
The Behind the Bastards.
So, going back to Neutral Milk Hotel and going back to OTC, OTC, or Olivia Tremor Control, had this sound which incorporated kind of a mix of Beatles and the Beach Boys. And so then we started talking and he said, I got, you know, kind of into the Beach Boys because of the Pet Sounds sessions. And Brian Wilson of the Beach Boys, who is often considered the genius behind the Beach Boys, wasn't often a touring member of the band.
Didn't he do most of the writing?
Yeah, he did a lot of the, yeah.
And then he sort of dropped off and became very, like, almost recluse.
He did kind of later, and then he kind of got back over it. He met this woman, but he had anxiety attacks really bad. Okay. And so when he was going on the airplanes, after a short while into there starting to get big and touring, I think he was on, actually they were going to tour in Japan if I remember correctly, but he was having these anxiety attacks. And so finally he said, I don't want to tour anymore. I just want to stay here and work on the music. Mm-hmm. So he did that. And then that led to him working on Pet Sounds, which he got a little carried away with, like, the recording of. But for music nerds and Beach Boys nerds even, Pet Sounds is kind of their most critically acclaimed album. It's got a lot of their hits on it. Every music nerd that I know loves Pet Sounds. And when they were recording Pet Sounds, they had this group of session players who are just like the instrumentalists that play like all the different instruments. The group that recorded on Pet Sounds, he said, oh, they had a name. I can't remember, but it was kind of neat to listen about the camaraderie that they had. This group of session musicians ended up being considered like one of the greatest music groups of all time. And they recorded together for all of these famous albums and different people, but they were later known as the Wrecking Crew. And the Wrecking Crew was a loose collective of session musicians based in Los Angeles whose services were employed for thousands of studio recordings in the 1960s and 70s, including several hundred top 40 hits. The musicians were not publicly recognized in the era, but were viewed with reverence by industry insiders. They are now considered one of the most successful, prolific session recording units in music history. And they were the band that Phil Spector used to create his wall of sound. So when you hear a lot of bands that have that kind of orchestral background, Phil Spector was kind of the creator of that. Phil Spector, did I say that twice? Phil Spector. But he created that kind of orchestral background that you hear in a lot of like big produced music, because at the time they were listening to radio, and he realized that that sound was something that played really well over the radio.
I just realized in the course of this conversation that I used to always kind of make fun of you a lot for, I would say something about a particular actor or actress, and I would ask you to give me an example, since you worked in the, you know, movie industry, to give me an example of a movie or TV show that they had been in that I might recognize. And you would always choose the absolute most obscure reference to be like, oh yeah, remember, you know, Tom Hanks from, I'm trying to think of a movie that no one's ever seen Tom Hanks in before, but that would be the one that you would always give me, rather than saying, I don't know, Big or The Money Pit or
Road to Perdition.
God damn it. See, you're doing it again. I just realized that this podcast is like your geeky wet dream, that you only get to talk about the most absolute obscure music that's ever existed. And then be like, yeah, remember that time that this whole band existed that you've literally never heard of? It's the most world-renowned session musicians of all time that you can name maybe one person from. This is like,
Campbell.
This is your geeky childhood dream right now.
The wrap-ups. You're not talking about my actual guests. You're talking about
I'm talking about the wrap-ups where you spout obscure facts at me.
Okay.
And I just stare at you because I don't know what you're talking about.
You ever hear the Monkees?
Yeah, them. Yeah.
Yeah. These guys were the session musicians that recorded behind their first two albums.
Thank you for bringing it back around for me.
Frank Sinatra.
Okay.
People like that.
Ever I just appreciate like once or twice you throwing me a bone of something I've heard of.
The Beach Boys.
Hey, you already did it and I appreciate you. I love you.
Most of the players associated with the Wrecking Crew had formal backgrounds in jazz or classical music. The group had no official name in its active years, and it remains a subject of contention whether or not they were referred to as the Wrecking Crew at the time. Drummer Hal Blaine popularized the name in his 1990 memoir, attributing it to older musicians who felt the group's embrace of rock and roll was going to wreck the music industry. Some of Blaine's colleagues collaborated his account, while guitarist bassist Carol Kay contended that they were called the Click. Another unofficial name was the First Call Gang, sometimes referred to as the Wall of Sound Band. There you go, Crystal. That's the Wrecking Crew.
Thank you.
There's a movie about them from 2008, and I don't know if I've seen it. So it's a documentary, so maybe you'll be interested if
maybe
we watch it.
Maybe that's a thing I should watch.
Yeah, I want to watch it because I feel like I know this story and I've seen video footage or film footage of them playing, but I don't remember watching an entire documentary. So the Wrecking Crew. Not a whole lot more here. One of us said gazillion in the episode. I don't know who, but I wrote it down on the paper, so I know that it was... I wanted to look up.
You know that it happened.
And I wanted to look up the etymology of gazillion.
It's a sixth grader in Kentucky somewhere that just made it up one day.
If his name's Greg.
I mean, a sixth grader in Kentucky, I feel like the odds of his name being Greg is fairly decent.
It seems that what I found is made up. Gazillion, it means a very large amount. And it's in a lot of dictionaries. Like gazillion is
Did you have to Wikipedia gazillion to find out that it means a very large number?
No. I thought it was interesting that it is in a lot of dictionaries. It's in like the Oxford Dictionary.
Oh, okay.
And yeah. But the etymology is lacking. And there's...
No shit.
So I think that this is funny, but I found a guy named Greg who gets quoted a lot, and it looks like the most elaborate bullshit answer ever on what the etymology of gazillion is. So I wanted to, I thought it was kind of impressive. The funny thing is though, Greg's etymology, I found it quoted in multiple places and it seems that Greg completely pulled this shit out, but because there's not a lot there, like other people were like, this guy Greg says.
Greg from Kentucky who's in sixth grade.
But he's gotten pulled from so much that he's high up in like the search engine. So even though I went like three pages back, like Greg's right at the top. I think his website's like gregology.com or something like that. This is Greg's etymology. Gazin from Latin earthly age. Oh, gatin. Yeah. That was me doing the reverse sound. Gazin from Latin, earthly edge or end of the earth, abbreviated to gaz. Literally 28,819 ancient Greek. Miles, 12. One full revolution of the globe. Therefore, a gazillion has 28,819 times 3 zeros, and a gazillion is. And then it's just like shows this like one with however many zeros behind it. Etymology of ilion from Latin, mille, thousand, plus augmentive suffix, eon or on, literally big thousand. That was Greg's. So ilion... I looked this up. This is the real one. Ilion suffix is combined with Latin prefixes for names of integers in order to form names of powers of a million or a thousand greater than 1 million. Thus, we have the names billion, trillion, etc. And also gazillion and kajillion.
I don't know, man. Sounds legit to me.
No, the last part was right. I just added on the gazillion and kajillion. Gazillion, and I think kajillion is also in dictionaries, but it's also just says a large amount.
Gotcha.
And that's all I have.
All right. Well done.
Now you know about Elephant Six.
Oof. Yeah.
Olivia Trimmer Control, Milk Hotel.
Yes, that was a walk.
They have the best names, though, of Montreal.
They've got great names.
Elf Power.
Oh, Lord.
Hey, guys. All of you that listened on day two or came back for day one, thanks for coming. And next week... think we are going to do another two-parter coming up here in the next couple of weeks, and a really awesome band that I just love so much.
Have you been updating your Spotify playlist?
I have
bands lately.
I have done it up until I got to put Matt's on there today. I'm supposed to do that tonight.
Yeah.
So the Spotify playlist has a few songs from each episode, and I really love this playlist. And,
yeah. Yeah.
And it's like, man, that is such a good playlist.
Getting
and
I'm some
like,
good feedback on
and,
it.
And then, yeah. And then it's the people from the show. And it's like,
it's a fun way to refer back to what's going on.
Right.
On the show.
I thought about doing a second playlist for all the like random, this kind of thing where like a deep like the dive songs playlist.
That you, no, like the songs that you sing at the beginning of each of the wrap ups.
Maybe I should do a.
Maybe you should.
Yeah. Maybe I'll put
maybe
together.
Just for me, just a private playlist just for me. So I know what the hell you're singing about.
Well, all right. I love you.
Love you.
And just remember, kid, we're all in this together.